This episode of Therapist Connect podcast is sponsored by WebHealer, the number one website provider for private practice therapists. Serving the community for 20 years, WebHealer offers a non-technical and fully supported online platform helping therapists use the internet to grow their practice. Whether you need a website, a booking system, or even a secure email address for your practice, WebHealer can help. Contact WebHealer today via www.webhealer.net and use the coupon Therapist Connect for £100 off their Do It For Me service.
Welcome to the Therapist Connect podcast, a podcast for therapists by therapists.
Hi, welcome to the Therapist Connect podcast. I'm Layla Bishop, one of the volunteers here at Therapist Connect. And this is an in-conversation episode where we'll be exploring anti-fatness in therapy and what it can be like for people in larger bodies and people with eating disorders to access therapy. These can be difficult topics, and if you think you might be affected by them, please give this episode a miss. For this episode, I am joined by two special guests, Mel Trevuco, who is a trainee therapist, has her own blog, The Compassionate Therapist, and has written about fat phobia for Therapy Today. I'm also joined by Bernie Wright, who works for the National Centre for Eating Disorders. She's a Master Practitioner and Registered Supervisor and now focuses on training.
Now, this is, I guess, quite an interesting topic and probably one that a lot of people wouldn't have come across, and it's exactly why I wanted to bring it. And so I'm going to just discuss a little bit about what anti-fatness is, and then we can talk about then how this affects therapy. So anti-fatness is known by other names as well. Some people call it weight stigma, some people call it fat phobia. And it's, I guess, discrimination against people who are fat or overweight or obese, or just other kind of names you might want, you know, people come across it. The reason, again, why we've used anti-fatness is that word fat. And we're going to come on to talk about that a little bit more. And it's just to really understand, you know, and have a discussion today about, well, does it affect therapy? You know, what about clients who come into our sessions and we do perceive them to be fat or overweight? Does that affect our work with them? And also, what about the therapist? You know, is the therapist fat? You know, what the clients think of us, or how do we judge ourselves and how well we can support and help people? And I think it's really something that isn't talked about a lot. It's something that's shied away from. So to start off our discussion today, we're going to talk about the word fat and why we use this word. And I guess, Mel, if I come to you first, if you can kick us off, and then Bernie and I can, you know, add to discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Wow. Well, how do I try and keep this down to a short answer? Because I'm like, there's such a lot that can be discussed just in this, because I suppose, like, I can talk about, I think people have different views on being called fat. Yeah. And I think it's very much for fat people to choose how they want to be described. For me, I sometimes do that. Sometimes I'd go with a slightly gentler in larger bodies. I avoid the fluffy stuff like curvy. although I don't think it's particularly offensive if anyone said anything about, you know, I wouldn't be too bothered. I suppose it's more for me thinking about what words shouldn't we use now. And I don't mean just in terms of really offensive stuff, but a lot of people are moving away from using the word obesity because it's linked in with, it seems quite a stigmatizing word linked into the BMI chart, which is outdated and problematic in lots of different ways. But then again, lots of people in the industry use it, as I'm sure Bernie will say in a moment. So in some ways, it's kind of necessary. So there's lots of different ways to describe. I suppose a short version is fat people get to describe what themselves however they want to. Thin people have got to be a bit careful when talking about fat people, because fat is a very triggering word. And it's got, yeah, lots of complications in itself. I'll stop there because this could be a huge conversation.
I absolutely agree. I think people should 100% be allowed to call themselves exactly what they feel they are comfortable with. And I do think that the stigmatisation in people in larger bodies has been absolutely appalling so far back now. So dreadfully totally disregarding of people and who they are. And I mean, you know, for me, it's, you know, it's a word, it's a word that people use, but it, the way we've been using it so far, it damages the whole person's psyche. You know, it's meant in a really derogatory way, and it's a demoralising way. And the government have just been so appalling in the way they've dealt with it. You know, and I know that I've had conversations with Mel before on my training, that basically we will use the word fat, and we will use all of these words that make people feel so bad. So when the government has this wonderful, brilliant new idea that once again will fail, like, you know, people just need to move around more, we're going to pay them, we're getting bicycles, we're getting all this total rubbish. After the, every time that they have one of these incentives they talk about, that all myself and all of my supervisees, we will have a dreadful couple of weeks, because they're not coming in thinking, what a great idea, we feel motivated. They come back in and they will be absolutely walking the walk of shame into our room. And it didn't take me very long to realise each time, you know, and I'll ask the question, you've been so secure in yourself, what's going on? And it's like the government, you know, I said, is it anything to do what they're now considering to do? So, and yeah, and I agree, the word obesity, I'm hoping that we will move away from it forever and ever and ever. And yet the problem we've had in because I work for the National Centre of Eating Disorders, and for a long, long, long time, and it's changing now, but people would only absolutely Google the word if they were looking for training, and they would say training in obesity. That is changing. But for a long time, that was the only way we could get, you know, we wanted to get as many people out there trained. And the great thing is it's worked, you know, and we're now getting so many people who are working in this field. And it's absolutely still appalling that these institutions, and I don't know about yours, Mel, I'm sure that your college would actually bring up the subject because they've got you. But most people go through 2, 3, 5 years of training. And I became the supervisor, and we had no, I mean, it was a long time back, but I'm still working with colleges or talking to colleges that are still can get through the whole curriculum without mentioning eating disorders or people in larger bodies.
Carry on, Bernie.
Which is a stigmatising in itself. You know, let's not mention the word. Let's not mention the fact that most, you know, the majority of people are in larger bodies. You know, it's more normal. It's more normal to be a bigger size than it is to be a smaller size. That's what we see, but to pretend it doesn't exist makes people see they're not seen. I mean, Eva Yonam in his book Love's Execution as Betty, there was prejudice going on there. So it's a case of, you know, it has to change. We have to change.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you both brought up some really interesting and good points, and I just want to pick out a couple. And the first thing you both, you know, mentioned and agreed on is fat people get to choose what words they use. And I just want to talk a little bit about that. And because I think a lot of people say, but why would you call yourself fat? That's such a horrible word. That's so derogatory. And, you know, you know, often someone will say, oh, I'm fat. And people, you're not fat, you're beautiful. And what's happened a lot in this, you know, in the fat community, larger bodies, you know, people, we're actually reclaiming the word fat to be, this is just a word to describe myself. It is a fact. You know, my body is large, I have fat. It's the same way I describe myself as short or brown hair or blue eyes, you know, or, you know, my skin tone. It just is something. But I think it's really important to recognise that, yes, people get to, you know, that there's still so many complex connotations with it, that it is a choice on, you know, whether you get to use it. And I guess it isn't something that's thrust on you, because you must be accepting of this word.
Absolutely.
Just to add a kind of personal note on that I think it's taken practice for me, because it is such a hurtful word, and I had it used against me in such a hurtful way when I was a child, that, like, trying to reclaim it takes time as well. So sometimes it's something that I might use sometimes and not others, depending on how I feel, because it takes time to kind of reclaim these things, doesn't it? And I think in the future, if enough people start doing that, it might be reclaimed in the same way that queer has maybe been reclaimed as well. But there can be a pressure, I think, in if you're trying to be a sort of body positive, fat acceptance person, that I sort of needed to get pushed into doing that. And sometimes actually maybe I just don't want to do that because it's still a bit.
Thank you for sharing that, Mel. And I think that links really nicely as well to Bernie, what you were saying before about, we have all these government programs that are against, we need to lose this fat. And again, we've got one space trying to reclaim the word. It's just a neutral term. But then publicly, it's got all these connotations on it. And how do we balance the two? And that was why I've used this word anti-fatness for this podcast, because fatness, there is an appetite, good pun, sorry. with fat, obviously, there is that desire to, be reclaiming. But as you said, Bernie, we've got these government campaigns and all these other kind of, other really famous one, cancer research one, of everything that's kind of in the public, stigmatizing it. And it's a really difficult balancing act, as you say, Mel, coupled with personal experiences when it's being used against you as a harmful thing. It's difficult to navigate.
It's impossible to navigate. And from my point of view, working as a specialist in this field, fear is not a motivator. So everyone terrifying people into losing weight and accuse it as saying you're going to die of COVID unless you get thin. I mean, what are people going to do? Starve for 3 to 6 months, lose a couple of stone, then put it four stone back on 3 months later. I mean, it was just another crazy idea that just made me so mad.
It's keeping people in a cycle, isn't it? It's the weight stigma is the harmful thing that is keeping people in this. And the language, I was just going to say, when we talk about words like fat, I think actually what my main concern is the way that the media and the government talk about the war on obesity and this like really violent language towards fat people. It's just, it's absolutely heartbreaking. It's so fear inducing as well. And it's so it creates so much division. But war on obesity and fight the fat, everything is fighting and war, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you're so right. In fact, when Diana Jade at the National Centre of Eating Disorders does her introduction on that part of our course, and she will read out this thing, and she said, "Well, how many really aggressive words are in that?" And I think that the saddest thing I find that even when I've been training for many years with the National Centre now, and we people who come in larger bodies, you can see they've been so stigmatized and separated. That they even come into the training and they're separated, almost like they feel that they're not okay to be there. And I just think that having being in a larger body doesn't make you any more unworthy or unlovable than anybody else. And that is what society's really got to get their act around and get their head together to actually move. It's got to change.
It makes fat people scared, probably, to go into trainings like that, to go into exercise spaces, to go nearly anywhere. It makes people afraid, and especially because medical professionals have often been the ones with this anti-fatness and this weight stigma as well, that can also be seen, that might be anticipated. Because the anticipated with weight stigma is almost as bad as actually having it, but the amount that people might anticipate that other professionals might treat them in the same way. Certainly where I work as an assessor for an eating disorder service now, the amount of people in larger bodies that come that just say, well, I'm scared that I'm going to die if I don't lose weight. They're terrified. They keep being told that they're going to die. And then these narratives from medical professionals are backed up by their family, who quite rightly are very scared. And just, they're like, their kids are scared they're going to die then. It's heart-wrenching seeing this amount of fear, but actually that keeps people in those same cycles. Mm-hmm. And this is why it's so heartbreaking, because that is what is maintaining the disordered eating, maintaining these habits.
That's such great points, Mel, and I could not agree with you more. And yet we actually had 100 people online training last week at the National Centre, you know, who treat, we teach a very, very, very different way of working with people in larger bodies. You know, we don't ever sign up for weight loss. You know, we talk about, if they come to us, we're literally, I say to my clients, you know, I'm not going to work with you on weight loss. You'll have come to me, and, you know, because you want a quick fix. And however, what I will help you with is what you want, your relationship with food, and everything else will follow. Yeah, and people get into habits of eating because they've been stigmatized and because they've been bullied and scared and feared. And, you know, when every time I notice when we put this fear, people will, you know, people are far, far more likely to binge and to overeat or to undereat or whatever it is keeps people scared. And yet we have so few people, doctors, medics. I had one recently on my training. I nearly fell off my seat. I said, thank you so much for coming. Where are the rest of you? Again, that's got to get educated.
Absolutely. Because I think what people think and what we're told is, you know, these narratives of, you know, what the eating disorder is. And as you said, Mel, you know, you have people in larger bodies who are scared for their life. Mm-hmm. Because they're being told they're overweight, but also people in larger bodies can experience eating disorders and very serious ones, and they're just brushed under the carpet because, well, you don't look anorexic because it has a look. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Mel knows a huge amount about this, and it sounds like you do too. Yeah. But I mean, 50% of people who are in a larger body will have an eating disorder. You know, if you don't deal with the eating disorder first, which can be extremely painful, and like, you know, and so many people like that with atypical anorexia. I've worked with lots of people in a larger body, and it's a case of how awful for them to feel that, what if, you know, if I just go to Weight Watchers or Slimming World, and they're going to do this for me. I mean, it's in order to, you know, get, we call healthful to gain health. We just don't talk about losing weight. Yeah. Because that's what the stigma's always been about, to lose weight.
I think a good example of that recently was Tess Holliday, the plus size model in the media, where people just reacted so strongly to her saying that she had anorexia. It's just like people can't, I think, to the outside world, maybe people who don't know very much about eating disorders, they just see people have restrictive eating disorders and that's what everybody has and they're all thin. But it's only actually about, it's like, what, 6% or 7% or something of people who are underweight with an eating disorder. Mm. And anorexia is the least prevalent one. Mm. So really, if we looked at the landscape of eating disorders, what people don't see is that it would be people in larger bodies and not just with binge eating disorder. Yeah. Atypical anorexia is just, I've had a whole conversation with someone recently for the In Conversation series I've been working on for the charity. We were talking about atypical anorexia and Zoe Barefoot Rebel, her name is, she's activist, absolutely brilliant, on Twitter. And she says it's basically atypical anorexia is just anorexia with added weight stigma.
Absolutely.
And all of this stems from categorizations from the BMI as well, which in itself, the Women and Equalities report not long ago said we shouldn't be using it, should be moving completely away from that, which is going to be an incredibly difficult thing to do because it's so, we rely on BMI so much, but that's what's causing a lot of this stigma. We tell people that they're not thin enough to have an eating disorder. We tell people that they are too fat to have an eating disorder. And it's all because of these BMI like categories as well. It's hurting everyone. This weight stigma is hurting everybody.
It absolutely is. And it breaks my heart. And as you know, I campaign about it all the time because it's absolutely outrageous that we are still using, your BMI is not low enough, so we can't work with you. Go away and get iller. Go away and get really ill and then come back and we'll see what the hell we can do with you. But until then, and of course, you're telling people who are either in larger bodies and anorexic, but you're telling them, and they're, the one thing they think they're good at is starving. But you're telling them there's other people who are more worthy of them because they're getting the treatment because they're nearly half dead. It's just, it's for me, it's crazy because you then rather than just get all these people in very, very young who are starving themselves or whatever they're doing before they go into binge eating or bulimia or whatever they morph into. If they get them early on and we just get interventions in when they're sort of 15, 16, 17, which is why people at the National, like us at the National Centre, are so successful, because we get them in early and they haven't got time to go through the NHS system 4, 5, 10 years and become revolving door patients. It's just a false economy.
Mm-hmm. It is. And as you say, Bernie and Grace, it is heartbreaking to see all these people suffer. And I think actually leads nicely onto one of the other areas I wanted to discuss with this, is when we talk about, you know, people in larger bodies, and you know, but what about health always comes up. You know, like Mel's wonderful article on Therapy Today, response to it, well, I'm going to only think about the health risks associated with being overweight. When we could, you know, we could actually, we probably will discuss that there's still lots of physical health risks of, you know, eating disorders. But where is mental health when we talk about what about health in, you know, kind of these cycles, as you say, that you get, people get stuck in when trying to lose weight for dear life because they're told that's the right thing to do?
And it just decreases the ability. It increases the shame, the depression, you know, all of these things that that adds, because we haven't been, that they haven't been supported or given any psychoeducation of what, you know. Then there is an argument that yes, there are a lot of people who will make themselves very ill because they are living on food that is not healthful. And I always say 80-20, 80%, you know, you eat okay, 20% you eat the hell what you want without that rigidity or that craziness of, you know, weighing or any of that. Which is why I think we teach it so much better at the National Centre, because it's more inclusive, it's behaviour changes if people want to. And if people want to actually gain health, then that is something also, and that is also something we do need to be mindful of too, because I'm also getting a lot of people who are feeling stigmatised for wanting to gain health, because they're upsetting what they call their, my health at every size people. What I'm really keen for us to do is to walk in that really down the middle. So I think we've always failed in the past because we've gone from, you know, sort of the rigidity of this is the way we've got to do all that orthorexia and all that crap that goes around, and the clean eating. And it's something about, or then we can then bounce into the what will make us eventually, if we do keep eating, you know, nothing but hamburgers, donuts. So yes, of course, we've also got to, there are health risks if that's all you eat is refined sugars and carbs, because it's proved obviously the inflammation can be problematic as you go on. And yet it's something about just living a life down the middle. And if people want to gain health and see somebody like me, then they should feel they can do that without being afraid of people who are in larger bodies and very and health positive, which I think is absolutely amazing. And we need to, it's a beautiful concept, but they also need to know that they can also do that. And we get an awful lot of results of people who do want to do that, just because they might want to, getting into their 50s or 60s, and they might want to play with their children, and you know, they might be getting some health benefits that you know, and what we can, at some stage, yeah, we have to say that there is health risks for being overweight long term, absolutely, but the stigmatization, and people need to choose and do exactly what's right for them, whether in a larger body or in a thinner body. And you know, recently I've been having an awful lot of private messages from people who are feeling sort of stigmatized almost for having a thinner body and then having a larger body. And I'm just, all I just want to keep saying is, we are all in psychological pain. Despite that fact, I do think that there is too much given. We need to give the same type of research into people who are in larger bodies and have got binge eating disorder and atypical anorexia, because that's where most people need the support. And are more likely to, you know, anorexia is extremely difficult to treat. And we're doing the best we can, but we also, but we can, there's so much we can do I thought I do and all my colleagues do with people, like when people are stuck in a binge eating cycle where they're spending every penny they've got, you know, on food, or if they're purging and vomiting, and they're running to the supermarket just to spend all their salary on binge foods. That's where I think we need to start really putting our effort and our energy into.
And I really liked what you said there, Fernie, about, I guess, gaining health. Because I think that's also what I wanted to touch on, because that health means many different things. You can say, you know, I don't think anyone here is going to sit here and be like, oh, if you only eat hamburgers and donuts, you will be healthy. And and people want to do that, and that's the life you want to live. You're also free to do that. Absolutely. But it is, you know, nutrition is multifaceted, you know, it's different things. But also, you know, I will only ever eat raw vegetables. That's also not a healthy diet. So yeah. So when you talk about gain health, I think it's these other things as well. And what you said about psychological pain, wow, if you could ease that psychological pain through, you know, lessening their eating disorder, that's also gaining health.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, because if we support our mental health, surely everything else will follow. You know, it's very important to put the physiology in place. If you're working with eating disorders, we have to deal with diet chaos and with nutrition, feeding the brain first. But it has to be like body, mind, and soul. We can't just sit there at the government and put nothing in apart from telling, you know, putting the finger of bullying on everybody, and say, you know, you're a drain on the system, and all these awful, disgusting things that are said. And that has to change. It really does. I feel so passionately, and I get very angry about it.
Me too.
Me agree. We're doing this podcast because, you know, and Maya's really keen to raise this awareness of all these, you know, why anti-fatness, and, you know, why any stigma towards anyone obviously is bad, but we want to talk about towards larger bodies and the impact it has. And I think Mel, you said really lovely before, it benefits everybody. I don't know what the exact word, but everybody gains, and then that gain in health, we all gain if we can, you know, be a bit more, I don't know what word is, relaxed, or just less that aggressive language. If that doesn't exist, then everybody benefits.
Yeah, everybody benefits, and it's everybody's job to do it. It's not just for fat people to fight against fat phobia, because everybody is growing up in a world of weight stigma and fat phobia. So we see this in normal size bodies. I'm doing air quotes, but like you can't see that on the podcast, I realize. You know, like it's what makes kind of thinner people or people in average size bodies also want to lose weight. It's what generates the world of weight stigma that we live in. And we all have these biases that we need to unpick. And I think it's about helping people understand where those views have come from, understand coping mechanisms that they've maybe created in food, but especially, and something we'll probably come on to, is that especially needs to be done in counsellors, not just ones who are working in eating disorders, but in anyone who's going to be a counsellor, because as we've seen, even the most perfect, air quotes again, perfect therapist in Yalom can still be very fat phobic.
Yes.
And just going on to that, it's a health thing that we were just talking about as well, just coming back to that, in terms of gaining health, I think health is about mental health, it's about sleep, it's about stress, it's about so many more things. And we've all grown up in this world that tells us that thin is healthy. And that's what we really need to be unpicking, because these narratives are just not, they're just not necessarily true. And it's stopping us from being able to help people, because it's just spreading fear instead. And, you know, as Bernie says before, like, fear is not a motivator. This weight stigma is not going to help anybody. So it's sad to see every single government initiative just play into making this worse and drive more hatred and drive more weight stigma towards people, you know. And it's just, and doctors and nurses and healthcare professionals not recognize eating disorders in people in larger bodies and actually just recommend weight loss, which was the problem that they got, which is the reason they got into it in the first place, and it perpetuates the problem. So it spans the whole world, and I don't think we're seeing this yet, because there's a lot of other inequalities that we're still not talking about and dealing with enough. And I don't think if we haven't even sorted out those other inequalities, then it's still going to be a while till we get to fat phobia. But I think that this ties in when we talk about racism and gender and everything, we can be having those conversations all together because they do tie in together.
Yep, I absolutely agree. I was sort of writing something about that the other day and I couldn't agree more. And we just, it's something about people are people and they're all unique and individual and amazing, regardless of their size. And I think that, and you're quite right about you know, health, it's not necessary. Or in fact, it's often people who are thinner that may have the weight problem, the health problems going forward, you know, because they're not, luckily they haven't, and there's lots of the brilliant, brilliant books by Sick Enough that people should really read. And she's got some great points in there about that.
I think just to add a personal note as well, that when I was younger and I was teased through every kind of exercise I did and made to feel like I didn't fit in and bullied at school and things, it really didn't make me want to go and exercise. It's because of this, it actually puts people off exercise. And then there's the awful hypocrisy of, you know, the myths about fat people of just needing to get up off your couch and go and exercise, but actually at gyms and fitness classes aren't safe spaces for people in larger bodies, because there's the fear of what if I get filmed in the gym, like what if I go to a yoga class and I'm the biggest person there and I can't do it. It's really, really damaged my relationship with exercise, so I had to rebuild that back up again, because I'm just a person who wants to be able to exercise for joy. And we just have all these hypocrisies on us. Like, people want to be able to go and eat. It's because of the standards and the stereotypes put on us that many times as fat people, we're actually internalizing as well. It's the internalized fat phobia that runs so deep as well.
It does. It's like so, so deep. It's almost buried within ourselves. And, you know, and I still see it now, people at the gyms, and they say, oh, my goodness, you know, wasn't she brave coming in? Can you, you know, fancy her using that? I mean, you think, no, what, you know.
And also, that's what people want fat people to do.
Yeah.
You're being told that fat people just need to move more, and then you are doing something, and then you're being ridiculed for it. So.
Yeah,
and then they don't sell activewear in your size either. Yes. Like, they have limited size. Sorry, the activewear is just for thin people, but actually fat people go and move. It's then I think this whataboutery of health is not actually really about health. I mean, for some people, they're trying in a well-meaning way, but for a lot of people just on the internet, they don't care about other people's health. The people who comment on the internet do not care about your health. They're just following a narrative and they want somebody to blame because the NHS doesn't have enough money. So fat people become scapegoats and go, well, it must be their fault because they're costing the NHS too much. The rate we're going, I think that eating disorders will end up costing. I don't think there is an epidemic. Like, there isn't an obesity epidemic, in my view. There is on the way to being, or probably an eating disorder or a disordered eating epidemic going on. And that's why it needs help and understanding and training and not stigma.
Mm. Absolutely. And in our training, which is with people in larger bodies, I mean, it's under no illusion by the time people leave after the training that, you know, if they still go out and work in that way, which is so stigmatizing and will keep people it's traumatizing. You know, it is absolutely traumatizing over time. To go through all of this. I mean, I don't know if you saw that with Liz Jones, the anorexic journalist. I don't know if you saw that recently. I found it absolutely staggering. She look at it. But she actually went. She decided to spend one day, and she in a sort of a surgical sort of fat suit, and she.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw that.
She was just horror, you know, day she just couldn't believe how she became invisible and yet very visible by people's reactions and stigma and just the way people are, you know, and it's, and a lot of help comes from parents. A lot of a lot of parents, you know, are very against people in larger bodies. So it's hardly surprising that their children, Deanna always says that the children who are in overweight at school are the ones that really, really struggle, you know, very, very early on. And, you know, anything's fine, but not to be in a larger body, it's...
Yeah, I literally thought that fat was the worst thing that you could ever be. Like, yeah. that's what I always remember from a really early age, that that's just the thing that I've desperately got to try not to be. It's really hard to try and move through the world, even if you had a parent that was, like, quite supportive, when the government and your people at school, peers, teachers, like, everyone, nearly everyone that you meet is going to reinforce this message. Like, it is just so many people, it's so hard to fight back against. So it really does feel like a fight. Like, now in the circles that I'm in and the stuff on social media, sometimes I see a lot of people with the same views as me. So I've got myself in a little bit of a bubble, but I do have to remind myself that if I see adverts or I see another government obesity strategy, then I'm very quickly crashing back down to earth and going, oh yeah, I remember now. I remember now. Yeah, it's really hard to live. It sounds dramatic, but it's hard to live in a world where people really hate you. And I mean, there's a lot of groups in groups of people who are very much discriminated against. So I'm not taking anything away from any group, but we do have to be honest and say there is a hatred and a fear of fatness, and a fear of fatness drives all sorts of different problems in our society. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, I've heard it, I think, I'm sure you said, Mel, that there was, when you were growing up, there was something about being in a larger body and you weren't good at school, not right at school, and then your parents, or was it that your, but I've heard that so many times, that, you know, then the parents are starting on you because the government's starting on them, and it's, you know, I'm really not okay, because not only my kids, people calling me names at school, Now they're putting my parents in to say that I've got to be put on the diet or whatever, and it's not going to do any difference apart from internalized shame that people carry through for the rest of their lives, you know. And I work with people in their 50s and 60s, and it's just it's still, even though I've been doing this job for years and years and years, it's still, when I do that, you know, when I do a piece of work, which is a lifeline, which Mel's seen a couple of times, and it's, you know, and they look back and think, and you just know, you can see where it started, and it certainly wasn't. And of course, genetically, some people are in bigger. A lot of people have had genes that have been there. You can't fight against so much, but we just assume that, you know, so many people got thin privilege. I mean, I've certainly had eating issues in my time. You know, most people who end up in the National Centre have. But mine was probably more of an overeating issue and a sort of binging issue. And yet, at the end of the day, I still had a thin privilege. You know, I believe that passionately. And you know, and a lot of, you know, because even though, you know, what I was eating, I should have been a lot bigger. End of. But it's, and a lot of us are like that, and it's, but that's what people don't actually take into account.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say on that, I think that there's, you know, I've been told some pretty awful experiences from thin people who have assumptions made about them because they're thin, like assuming that they have anorexia or something just because they're thin, or comments like, just go eat a burger, that kind of thing, you know. Yeah. And it's awful, but it is quite different to systemic fat phobia, because, like, and that's not to take away any of that pain, because that's a really hurtful, awful thing to happen to them. Mm-hmm. That's a traumatic thing, and it's bullying, it's, you know, it's awful. But when people in very large bodies can't even move through the world because it doesn't accommodate them, that's a wider systemic issue, where you can't, you know, where maybe you have trouble booking onto a flight because the seats aren't big enough, or you can't sit in a waiting room chair. Like, it's just these things that everybody else will overlook, in the same kind of way as disability. Like, when the world doesn't access you, that's a trauma as well in itself, because you're othered and you're told you don't, like, literally, you don't fit here, you don't fit in.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the amount of people that said to me that they bought, they buy all their clothes from a charity shop, or and their dream was to just to actually find a shop that could actually clothe them. No, our job as a society is to find shops that do have those clothes, you know, that are in beautiful fashions and everything else, that people don't have to go to charity shops and you have cause, you know, in shops that we know are sort of people in larger bodies, because it needs to be the norm, as opposed to, you know, the people shouldn't feel bad going into shops, and they should be able to go in lots of shops that can accommodate their clothes too, rather than actually having to buy online. Or it's so difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I want to thank you both for sharing some personal experiences there, and I guess especially you, Mel, really highlighting how just the difficulty and damaging how it is just to exist in a larger body. And I guess what I think will bring us neatly on to is, because I haven't really touched on this yet, is how we deal with this in the therapy room, or not, but I guess even actually to that point, educating counsellors that this is actually probably quite a common experience, you know, for someone in a larger body, that actually just existing is difficult. And I think, you know, and what I wanted to highlight is that in my training, eating disorders weren't really discussed from memory, but especially, you know, I mean, we know also diversity anyway and bias aren't covered as well as they could be and absolutely should be, but the only reason weight stigma was brought up was because I did a topic on it. We had diversity, you know, we were asked to bring something to diversity, and I brought up weight stigma. And I know it wasn't else brought up because nobody else did that topic. And I just again I think, so how on earth is it that are we you know, can we support these clients who are coming to us with shame, you know, internalized fat phobia, you know, these skewed conditions of worth of what the world has told us, when we're not even educating about it in the first place?
I think it needs to start in the colleges. I think because if we just bang it on straight into every training institution, whether it's, you know, doctors, nurses, teachers, you know, psychotherapists, counsellors, all of us, every single one of us, we need to be educated ourselves, and then the rest will follow. But until we get educated, until, you know, we're still, as I went back to the beginning, Lina, you know, 100 people turned up online last week to work at the National Centre, and we didn't have one doctor or health, expert amongst the whole lot. Every time Deanne says, any doctors here? we might have the odd psychiatrist. And of course, the psychiatrist have really got to learn how to work with people who rather than just give them a label of some kind of demoralising, dehumanising label, to find out what's really going on.
Absolutely. And I think that education there is, it needs to happen at so many levels. And I guess I want to kind of share my own experience, and that, you know, when I was receiving personal counselling, and I was talking about my weight, and actually I was getting to a place where I was, you know, I'm happy, you know, I'm the largest I've ever been, and that's okay. And my counsellor pulled out, oh, you know what's really good, MyFitnessPal, let's calculate your calories in the session.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh dear.
And for some reason, I stayed with that counsellor a bit longer, but I obviously never discussed that topic again. And that's just so shocking to me. It was shocking then. I just didn't know how to react. And now I'm a lot more well-versed in this area and everything. But I think that's, again, I don't think that's a unique experience to me.
No, I've worked with lots of counsellors over time. I mean, not just in a sort of professional environment, because I've worked in like counselling charities in admin roles and things. And yeah, there's been ones on sort of various different diets. Some of them involve like fasting, starvation days, when they've got 7 clients back to back. And I'm just back then I didn't know what I know now because it's quite a long time ago, but yeah. I was still thinking, is that really right to like not be eating for a whole day? And also, if you have these views about dieting and want to change your body, mm-hmm. this person was actually thin anyway, how is that gonna, what might you unintentionally collude with as a therapist, even if yeah. they are not talking specifically about weight? But I kind of now just think, how can we expect counsellors and psychotherapists to challenge this or recognise it as a problem when the BACP, one of the main membership bodies, had a diet advert in the back of it for what seems like years? How long do you think it was there, Bernie?
At least 1 year and 2 months and 21 days. And just for the record, I'm still waiting for them to come back and see us, you know, about all of this. It's how I'm working with eating disorders, but so I'm pretty busy now, so I probably can't fit them in now, but there you go.
Yeah, do you want me to just explain a little bit about what that was?
Oh, sorry, I just assume everyone knows because it went on for so long, but Mel, please lead the way.
Yeah, I looked at, we got some back issues at work of therapy today, actually, and I kept looking back through them, and this advert, Cambridge Diet advert for ambassadors, so Cambridge Diet is sort of like the milkshakes and soups, those kind of things.
Meal replacement.
Yeah, meal replacement stuff. So, and in the classified bit at the back of Therapy Today, there was an advert sort of more geared towards counsellors to say, hey, why don't you be an ambassador? Because that'll go really well with being a counsellor. So because I'm a trainee, I only recently, last year, started getting Therapy Today, and I hadn't really seen it before that, and I just thought, this is completely unethical. Then I realised that Bernie had been working on this for quite a long time already, trying to pin them down to have a conversation about it, which has been incredibly difficult. So I said, what can I do to help? And Bernie said we could write a letter, because we've all been trying to do that. So I wrote a letter to and sent it to the BACP, which I seemed to just get a copy and paste reply that they'd sent to everyone, I think.
We all got the same one, I think.
We did, yeah. And then I also wrote into Therapy Today and did not expect a response. And then the editor of Therapy Today sent me an email and said, we want to publish your letter. And I was like, in the same edition as the actual advert, like, you can't make this up, can you, really? Yeah. So they published my letter saying how unethical and rubbish it was that they've got a diet advert in there along with the diet advert. But then a month or two later, it disappeared.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I don't think they've said anything about it. Have they said anything to you, Bernie?
It's about time I was sacked from Twitter for a while. I never found out why, but it was. But I did when I came back on Twitter. But we actually had two. We actually, the National Institute of Eating Disorders, we actually had three of us. Nick Diana Jade, another psychotherapist, went and had two meetings with them, and they were, each meeting was an hour a time, and they absolutely, even after all of that and all the letters, they still refused to remove it, saying that it's up to the therapist to self-regulate themselves. But selling authorising a diet that actually I've had people go psychotic on. So it's like, really? So there you go.
Yeah, and that's terrible. They need to be, I really feel like the BACP is one of the biggest membership bodies, really need to be leading the way on this. And for me, if they, I don't think it was them, it was probably just the person themselves who pulled the advert for whatever reason, for bad press, or maybe it wasn't working. It's a good thing it's gone anyway, but I would have really liked it to come from the BACP instead, and for them to put something out saying, we realise why this isn't okay. Yeah. But to me, that's not happened. So their views are still the same. So effectively they're saying, yeah, it's fine. Counsellors could end up being on diets. They might even have eating disorders themselves. They might have stigmatising views around fat people. And the other thing is, when I was first reading, like on my first foundation certificate course, we were given the Yalom Love's Executioner Fat Lady chapter to read. It was just that chapter, so I hadn't read the rest of the book. So it was quite shocking because I didn't know the style of the book. I just went straight in with that and was like, what is this? And I got back and everyone's always praising Yalom anyway, but everyone was having a conversation. It was just sort of how brave he was and how amazing he was for being honest. And I kind of went, I really don't feel okay about this. Like it, I don't think this is okay. I wasn't sure about myself then. So, and this was to my entire cohort as well. And I was like, I don't think this is okay. It's come from a real position of privilege. He doesn't challenge his own views at the end. He hugs his client who's lost weight and he can fit his arms around her. And the message that he's giving is not one of him challenging his own biases at all. And then people praise him for being very honest, which only shows their own fat phobia as well. So I think we could be taking that story now and using it in the way that I took it in and explain this on my cohort. And we had a conversation around it. And because Yalom is a really good writer, I feel like we can be using that story in a different way now and starting a conversation around fat phobia and kind of, you know, it's okay if we have these views about fat people. We don't need to beat ourselves up about it because we've all grown up in this world. But what we need to do is recognize it and then we can work with that. And I would love to see those conversations as a trainee counselor. I don't see any of this. We don't talk about food. We don't talk about eating disorders. We barely talk about race. We barely talk about gender. And, you know, within the kind of, I don't want there to just be a diversity session. I want it to be throughout our training. And I want that diversity of race to be linked with fat phobia because fat phobia has racial origins to it. And this is a conversation that can link together, and the richness, and especially in an experiential style, would be so brilliant on our counselling courses. It really would.
Absolutely amazing. I mean, I've always been astonished. I think there was something about a huge debate that went on for a ridiculous amount of time. I think I think it was on one of my tweets. I think I had about 200 slightly ridiculous talking conversations because I just said, you know, I can't believe that we're actually all talking about, you know, whether we should maybe have to cut our clients a cup of tea, talk to a supervisor about that. But yeah, but honestly, we've got thousands and thousands of things to worry about with people in larger bodies and how they've been treated. And as you say, all the diversity that goes on. And we don't even talk, you know, and things of people who have got, you know, who've got a learning neurodiverse, so they're autistic or they're ADHD. You know, that may affect their eating behaviour, but that's never talked about either.
I think it's seen as an other specialism, isn't it? Eating disorders, where people want to go and train and then they might do a couple of hours CPD and then they tick the eating disorder box, or people just tick the eating disorder box anyway because they think they can work with it. You know, I see that in listings like the counselling directory, there are people who I think just tick everything. If you're going to work as with eating disorders especially, you do need to go and do proper, really good, robust training like the ones that Bernie does. But I also think for people not working with eating disorders, we've got to take away this otherness and have generally relationships with food and weight stigma and fat phobia talked about together. Because as a counsellor, it would be impossible to never encounter anyone with like a food who's never had any body image issues with food or you're just going to never have like a fat client. You know, it has to be done. It has to be a core competency, as also talking about race and exploring whiteness, because there's so many white people in counseling and privilege and class and all these things to do with class, like class and obesity have a lot of links as well. There's so much brilliant stuff that could be explored. So if on my course now they try and have another conversation about if we should have a glass of water or if we should pass some tissues, I honestly I'm just gonna go mad.
My favorite one, Mel, was Liana, was the one that said, I've just seen a spider in my counseling, what should I do? I mean, really. But for all of you therapists who listen, please do not congratulate your clients on weight loss.
Really good point, Bernie.
They are not better off because they've lost a stone since they've been working with you. You shouldn't be discussing weight loss. It is something that they come to you for. I mean, I think it's, as therapists, we need to be asking our clients, you know, what is your relationship to weight, food and shape? And if they say, oh, I'm eating terribly, or I don't stop binge eating, do you want some support on that? And then if they say absolutely not, then you move on to what they want. But you can't ignore it. I had a client that came to me, and this is absolutely true. She'd been working with someone for 5 years. She had so much weight stigma about, and she's been so stigmatized, but she was desperate to talk about it. And it was, she said, it was the last session. Someone said to her, "I noticed we didn't talk about your weight." And it was like, what? You know, and that, I mean, I've heard that in varying degrees, in so different ways. Yeah. But and equally, when people come to people like me, they're just so grateful that it's that, you know, that it's out there. It's not a problem. It's not an issue. You know, you can talk. You can talk about what you want to talk about here. And you can, and we will work, you know, because we will support enough. We will support. I will support you. And I'm so sorry this happened to you, because it was wrong. You know, it was wrong, and that's the reality of it all. So I'm hoping we change. I mean, you know, I really do hope that people start understanding it, getting educated, getting, you know, that people are worthy of love and care and everything, and a beautiful, adventurous life in whatever damn body they've got, whether it's a small body or a large, whatever, you know, we are all unique and wonderful. And that's what I find so astounding about the counselling world, you know, that we teach, we give a voice to the core conditions, and yet we don't actually know what they are half the time, because the core conditions are allowing people to bring their shame into the room in whatever manner they want to bring it in, not to be afraid, and not to be able to come out and say, this is what I feel. And it's no surprise to me that people might have seen 3 or 4 therapists, and they will tell in the first session, finally someone gets it. And that's what we owe, the counselling world owe, the medical world owe, that type of knowledge to avoid stigmatisation going forward, to eradicate this awful stigmatisation going forward.
Absolutely.
I speak to, I've had this feeling that they don't have anybody else in their life, or they've never had anyone who isn't trying to encourage them to lose weight. Mm-hmm. I sometimes feel like I'm the only person they've spoken to that isn't colluding with this whole you've got to lose weight or you're going to die thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A lot of my private work focuses on body acceptance, you know, and again, like you, Ben, I say to people, you know, they come to me on my weight loss journey, and I say, I'm not here to support you, I'm not here to help you lose weight. You know, I want you to accept yourself as you are right now, as you will be in the future, and that maybe as you were in the past as well. It's, you know, and I kind of want to join 2 things you've both said and put them together, where Bernie, you were just saying then, you know, all people are people and all people are worthy. And what you said before, and that means everybody benefits. Again, if we're treating everybody with respect and that they're worthy regardless of what they look like or what we perceive their health to be, again, that just benefits everybody.
Absolutely. And we, you know, when I'm working with people and training people, you know, I'm not going to go away and say, you know, here's a diet sheet and this and that, I will go away and say things like, go and change one, you know, if they really do want to come to us, and it's their, you know, again, if people want to gain health and have, you know, become healthful and it's affecting their health, and that's where they've come. But, you know, we will be looking at things like change 3 things, you know, say 3 things to you normally say no to, 3 things you normally say yes to, and they cannot be anything to do with food, weight and shape, because they've got to know that you can change, but it's not, we're not going to clap you if you lose a pound. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not going to, if you stick, so, you know, it's just so wrong on every level.
Yeah, maybe it's really important for therapists to model that to their clients, that it doesn't matter to them if they've lost weight or gained weight, because then that can, you know, hopefully start to support them in seeing past making a change in their body, to look beyond to what's really going on, which might be something to do with self-worth or trauma, you know, whatever's kind of underneath that, that makes them want to change their body. But yeah, going back to the kind of equality thing, treating everybody equally, and everyone deserves, you know, anybody of any size. Mm. I suppose the difficult thing about equality is that that's the ideal world that we want to live in, but it doesn't happen unless people do the work to get there, because it, and it's the same, you know, with race or gender or disability or anything else. It's like, but we can't just say we want to treat everybody equally. We need to be doing the work to be able to help those people, and helping the ones who are the most stigmatized to be able to get there. And it's going to take a lot of work in our society, because we're basically, it feels very rebellious. Anything we say about size acceptance is pretty much going against what our government says. So I think for many people, it would be very difficult to get on board with. And so this is a longer journey, but counsellors are crucial in that, and healthcare professionals as well. And as Bernie says, this comes down to education and training. Ideally, education in schools, like for kids, I would absolutely love. Maybe I've just created a big body image resource. Maybe if I can, you know, they're talking about me writing some lesson plans for that, and get some body image stuff in schools, bring that in with diversity as well, bring in these conversations so that people can have them from a younger age.
Absolutely. I could not agree more. And stop wearing the kids in schools, please.
Yes.
Yeah. That's great for the podcast.
If enough parents will take their kids, because you can take your kids out of it, can't you? You can opt out. So we just get all the parents, please just opt out, and then they'll get the message.
Exactly. And eventually people find their voices heard loud and clear again, regardless of their size. That is the only hope we can have.
And I think, Mel, is really important to say this is a long journey. You know, we've kind of started this part of our discussion saying, you know, I guess, how can we improve things for counsellors? You know, and we've talked a lot about education, and actually, but it is a journey. We're undoing years of, you know, internalised weight bias, fat phobia, along with conflicting messages from the government. But I do, so that is a long journey, but what I would like to kind of, as we start to come to an end, think about was things actually we can do and isn't really talked about is, I guess, practical considerations when working with people in larger bodies. And I guess the main thing really I'm thinking about is, what is your counselling room set up? Do you have furniture that's appropriate for someone in a larger body? Have you got a beautiful chair, but it's got the most annoying armrests?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's really important that you've got furniture that people aren't going to come in and think, a bit like they've done on aeroplanes, would I be able to get out of that?
Yeah.
Or, you know, can I fit in there? And it's just another stress, another pressure that people have to go through, which is just makes a difficult time even harder.
And another thing that maybe gives a message to people, like, you don't fit in here. You know, this place isn't for you. It isn't set up for you. Yeah. But I mean, that problem is probably in colleges and in educational settings as well, because, you know, the chairs and the places that we're sitting and working from in universities and colleges potentially don't really cater for that either. I think it's something that would mostly just slip people's minds. In the same sense that having, you know, disabled access, or even thinking about access for you know, thinking about people, lots of different accessibility problems, basically, that doesn't cross people's minds unless it's specifically talked about in training. At the moment, I'm finding that you have to go somewhere else to learn about privilege and about thinking about different types of people. So I had to go elsewhere and do training on gender and on race and on eating and things, because it's not in my course. So it adds the extra pressure of, I just don't feel like they're really, you know, and that's just my course. I think that's all the courses. I've been a couple of different colleges. I think it's across the board. It's through curriculums. But I mean, I think what we're really talking about here, sorry to bring it back, you were trying to keep it practical and I've taken it big again, but it does come back to privilege. It comes back to people not thinking about these things, not thinking about chairs, not thinking about access, not thinking about stairs, because they don't need to. And there's a massive level of privilege that comes through counselling training from the top, through institutions. It's completely institutionalised and systemic. So no one's going to bring it up, because there's all this privilege. And mm-hmm. that's where we're missing out.
Yes, and I find in counselling institutions often there's a fear to speak your mind or to say what's really thinking about, because they're the ones that are actually passing you through. And I think that is another thing that I don't agree with. You know, that we should have our voice silent in the same way people in larger bodies have, because we're worried about getting through our qualifications. We need, you know, there's something about everyone has a right to a voice, whether it agrees with the university and the colleges or not, as long as it's said respectfully and with respect. I think everyone's voice should be heard.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think, Emel, you're so right to say, you know, I know you still ask the practical question, mm-hmm. but it is related to the big picture, the privilege, you know, and it's, as you say, most people, and myself included, I wouldn't even thought about, oh, I need to make sure my chair is appropriate if I hadn't gone through this work. And which is why I made a point of mentioning it now, because you just don't think about it unless it affects you. And that's, as you said, that's what we need to change, but it needs to change in colleges and, you know, in training and just, you know, in so many levels, because this is how deep rooted these difficulties are.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Long and enduring.
Yes. Yeah. Lovely. Well, we're about to come to the end and I want to thank you both so much for coming on. And I also wanted to invite you, if you want, is there anything else that you want to add to our discussion today that we haven't brought up, that you feel would be important for our listeners and our therapist community to kind of know, or again, that would be of interest to them?
I think when we talk about looking at our clients and walking in their shoes, let's really walk the talk and walk in their shoes. And at the moment, I don't think that's what we've been taught how to do.
I would just say, I suppose maybe I'm saying this to myself as much as others, but for training counsellors out there, you know, speak up and fight for these things that we should be learning, because we're going through quite a revolutionary time in terms of counselling. It's a very exciting time to train to be a counsellor, because COVID pushing everybody online, I think, has fundamentally changed the way that we'll do things. Some people were working online before, but now a lot more are going to. And with being online, that brings accessibility. And now we've got opportunities. We've got so many opportunities. We're training, changing the way they're doing. I don't, you know, my university has a blended approach now. This going forward can only really help inclusion and diversity. And this is kind of, you know, what it all comes back to as well. So I think there are positives in that and we're moving in the right direction, but it is, you know, there is an opportunity. There's an opportunity here for people who are going to be, who are thinking about training to be counsellors, who want to be like the sort of people going into it. We want to question ourselves. We want to be pushed out of our comfort zone. We want to do that. We wouldn't be training to be therapists otherwise. Mm-hmm. So like that's an opportunity. Like, and there's an opportunity here to look at these biases, and that includes weight stigma.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I really couldn't.
I agree. Well, again, thank you both so much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I thought I knew a lot about this subject, and you've both kind of taught me something, or just reminded me of things in a different way. And I feel our listeners will say feel the same way. But again, thank you so much to Mel and Bernie.
Thank you for listening to the Therapist Connect podcast. Go to www.therapist-connect.com for more discussions and debates.
This episode of Therapist Connect podcast is sponsored by WebHealer, the number one website provider for private practice therapists. Serving the community for 20 years, WebHealer offers a non-technical and fully supported online platform helping therapists use the internet to grow their practice. Whether you need a website, a booking system, or even a secure email address for your practice, WebHealer can help. Contact WebHealer today via www.webhealer.net and use the coupon Therapist Connect for £100 off their Do It For Me service.